So this interview with Martha Shelley on November 7th, 2020 is being conducted by Julie Rosenzweig, Tiffany Chan, and Sadie Hogund, MSLAS students at Pratt Institute School of Information, and in partnership with the Lesbian History Archives. The conversation we will be having today with Martha will include her personal history, activism, and work on the radio show Lesbian Nation. We're conducting this video from our respective homes in Brooklyn and in Portland. All right, Tiffany.
Okay, all right. So let's kick off this interview. We do have some general questions for you in the beginning. In the beginning, we just want to know like a quick personal history. How did you get involved in just feminism and or lesbian activism?
Well, I was always different. I knew that when I was a kid. And I didn't, but let's skip way ahead. back in 1963, a therapist that I had been encouraged to see gave me a copy got me to buy a copy of The Feminine Mystique. And oh boy, that opened the doors for me. and then by then I knew I was a lesbian. There's a whole lot more, but we only have an hour. 1967, I joined the Daughters of Bilitis, because I was useless in the bars. I couldn't meet women that way. I didn't dress right, I just didn't fit. Mm-hmm. Didn't fit into the butch femme stereotype, anything.
I get it.
So I met, I would meet people there, and right away, the people who were running the organization asked me to run for office. So they asked me to run for treasurer. I was very flattered. I was, 60? That was 1967. I was 24 at the time. Then I realized later on that I had run unopposed because nobody wanted the job. did that for a couple of months, not very well because I didn't know how to do bookkeeping. Then they made me president. I didn't know how to run an organization either. And finally, because I was one of the few people in the United States at that time who was willing to be out in public, they made me public spokesperson. That was fine. I got to go to abnormal psych classes and explain why we weren't abnormal. And besides, normal is something on a bell curve. And it's different from being, you know, mentally disturbed, which is what the shrinks used to say we were. Continued working with Daughters of Bilitis and being the public spokesperson. Mm-hmm. And then 1969 came the Stonewall Riot. Mm-hmm. By that time, I had already... I had been working at Barnard College. That was the most recent job I had. And I had, while I was being the public spokesperson, I had to go to my boss one day because I had given an interview with WOR Radio. They were doing a program on the so-called sexual revolution. And so I was representing Daughters of Bilitis and talking about being gay. And the next morning I walk into the office and my boss at Barnard College sallies into the office and she says, guess what? WOR Radio was here last night and they're doing a program on the sexual revolution and they're interviewing some of the girls in the new co-ed dormitory. And I just must stay up and listen to it. And I thought, oh, shit, she's going to hear me. So I was pretty freaked out. I went to, I called the woman who was running Daughters of Bilitis and said, what should I do? And she said, call WOR Radio. They'll take it off the air. They'll understand. There was no way I was going to do that. I'm sitting there with a picture of Martin Luther King above my desk, a poster that I had put there. I had been working in Harlem when he was killed. I couldn't back down. So at the end of the day, I went to the boss and said I was going to represent the Daughters. I was going to be on that radio show. And she said, mm-hmm. What for? I said, representing the Daughters of Bilitis. She says, what's that? I said, a civil rights organization for lesbians. And she gave me a big wink and said, help me out with my coat, dear. I'm going to be late. It's so nice that you people are doing all this organizing. Okay, so I found out a lot of the women in the faculty and administration at Barnard were on the same page as me. including the president of the college at that time.
That's good.
Then I, at the end of the year, they were going to extend my contract. I would continue to work for another year there. And I thought, I don't want to do this, because I had been told that I was, that academic freedom applied only to students and faculty, not to administrative staff. And I thought, then nobody's going to shut me up about anything. So I got this part-time job in Greenwich Village, typesetting, moved into a slum apartment in the East Village, and became more of like a part-time worker and full-time organizer. Mm-hmm. And then came the Stonewall Riot. Mm-hmm. And after that, I organized the first protest march, 1 month after. And out of that organizing came the Gay Liberation Front. So I was doing that, working on putting out the gay newspaper Come Out, which was put out by the Gay Liberation Front, working on Rat Newspaper when women took it over. I got involved with that. And then in 1972, Nanette Raynone, who was the program director for WBAI, asked me if I would be interested in doing a show, having my own show. Well, of course I jumped at that. And she got this young gay guy, to teach me how to use the equipment, how to edit tapes. And then I started going around and interviewing people and making tapes and putting programs on the air.
Wow. So you so just had
history.
Did you have just freedom to create whatever you wanted for the show? I guess we could ask our second question.
Yeah.
So jump in. Is that our second question was, how did you start Lesbian Nation, which you already hit on a little bit. But yeah, I would be interested to know how you created the content and why you interviewed the people that you did interview.
I had the freedom to put on whatever I wanted. Obviously, given that it was WBAI, and given who I was not going to put on some right-wing stuff. And I just interviewed people that I knew or had heard of, writers, poets, activists. And at one point, because I had made this fiery speech after being arrested and treated badly by the cops, and this guy from Arizona State U, invited me to speak in Phoenix. So I got an air ticket to Phoenix. I took my tape recorder with me and went around the Southwest doing interviews there. One of them was with the women who did this feminist art installation in Los Angeles. And to give you an idea of the way I would do things, there was part of it was this thing that Judy Chicago had done. There were different rooms and people would go into this house. And one of those rooms was called the menstruation bathroom. And it was spray painted red with rows and rows of tampons and things like that. Guys would go in there and freak out. And I thought it was pretty funny. So when I got to that part of the interview talking about this women's art project, I cut in with music. The girl that I marry will have to be as pink and as white as a nursery. You know, the girl I call my own will wear satin and laces and smell of cologne.
That's great.
Stuff like that.
That's iconic right there.
Yeah, that's so fun.
Then, are you familiar with Judy Grand's poetry?
I'm not.
If you're not, you should be. She was absolutely fantastic, another pioneer of our times. And she's still around. She lives in Palo Alto right now. But she did, she came to New York. She was promoting her book, it was the Women's Press Collective. There was this little group of women that would publish feminist stuff. I moved out to the West Coast in 1974 and joined them. That was after WBAI. But when she came to New York, I interviewed her. I didn't interview her. I just taped the poetry reading, which was extraordinary. It was the most extraordinary, powerful reading of her book, a short book, like a long poem called A Woman is Talking to Death. And when I think about it, I still tear up. It is so powerful. And I cut in with that, with the music, Olatunji's Drums of Passion. Another time I did there was a demonstration, you know, women came to this women's building, and there was various people demonstrating martial arts and how to defend yourself. So I grabbed my microphone and tape recorder, and when this woman was saying, and then you throw somebody like this, boom, and you'd hear the big thump. And my microphone was right there picking up the thump. And then you do this, so I picked up all of that stuff. And I did a program on, and it was all audio. You couldn't see it, of course. Right. But you could visually imagine because the woman was describing what she was doing. I had a lot of fun with that. And then I did, you know, interviewed women who did different kinds of arts, like Myrna Lamb, the playwright, and Bertha Harris. Neither of those women are with us anymore, who'd written, various books. You've got it all there on tape. All of those tapes that I hope are being saved.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that they are.
Our digital team has been, they've been very diligent with getting those done at the school. So we're just working on getting those audio files onto the Hearster archives, just working with them and getting them on. And I mean, of the audio files that you did donate, or just if you have ones that you still personally keep, did you have a favorite?
No, I gave them all. To the Lesbian Hearstery Archives.
Did you have a favorite one?
Gosh, you know how many years it's been? I can't possibly remember.
But I'm sure there were memorable ones. In this case, did you... since they probably were all like memorable in a way, did you have any difficulties with the show? Was there anything specific that was very difficult about the show that to this day you still think about, or you could have done better, or if you can go back in time, like you could have fixed?
I can't think of anything. People gave me a lot of latitude.
Oh, okay.
And they liked the show. It took me about 20 hours each week to produce one show. Mm-hmm. And the show came on Friday night. And that was because I edited, you know, I did my interviews, I did my editing, I did it very carefully. It was very tightly done. Not always, but almost all the time. And so that, during those 2 years, 72 to 74, that was my half-time job. And the other half-time job was working in this little typesetting company. I did that 3 days a week and paid the rent on my dinky little apartment.
Wow.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very inspiring. Mm-hmm. I'll continue with the next kind of set of questions. You're talking about kind of the reception you were getting at the time. I was wondering, like, what kind of listener engagement there was. Like, did you get sent any letters or anything like that during your time making the show?
I did not. But what did happen was that a couple of those shows, and I think one of them was the Judy Grand stuff, afterwards, WBAI asked people to pledge, and these shows were popular enough that people sent in quite a bit of money.
That's really great that was...
So, So that's all I know. Oh, yeah. And of course, you know, people who I would encounter in the street one way or another in the group were knew what I was doing and were supportive.
That's awesome. It's just, it's interesting to hear because like, I don't know, it's hard to imagine, at least for someone who grew up in kind of like the digital age of everything kind of like happening all at once, and picturing how this show could be so important to like the lesbian and queer community, even in such a like analog way, is really cool to see like how you got it done and spent so much time putting effort into it and how it had like a real impact. And like, I think, you know, people in our class are like really seeing that through the tapes.
We had to do physically was right. I would interview people mostly on my little cassette recorder. Then I would transfer that to reel-to-reel tape and then sit in the editing booth with the editing block and a razor and cut stuff in, the music or whatever. So I physically cut pieces of reel-to-reel tape, and then there was this, I don't know what we call it, it's kind of like scotch tape, only not, and you would splice the two pieces of tape together, and then you'd have a reel of the stuff you want to go on the air, you know, the 30 minutes of it.
Right.
So it was very physical, you know, not done digitally at all. We didn't have that equipment.
Right, yeah. So next question is, what was the kind of the decision to end the show, or why did the show come to an end?
Oh, I was bored. I had already said what I had wanted to say, and I wanted to move on and do something different with my life. And at that point, I had also... had a kind of a heartbreak with somebody who went off with somebody else, and I moved to California.
Mm.
Moved to Oakland to join the Women's Press Collective.
Mm. So kind of like a natural end. I think that's kind of poetic and it's good to let things like live a natural cycle and then leave if necessary.
Yeah, I just didn't want to do the same thing over and over again.
Right, right. If you could make a queer-centered show right now, radio show or otherwise, what sort of content would you like to cover or make if you still have any ideas?
Let me think about that for a minute. Okay, I think for me, the highest priority, I know that I'm, you know, my history politically has been mostly as a lesbian feminist activist. But right now, what I see as the highest priority in the world is what they call climate change. And if we don't do something soon and fast and hard about that, none of our rights as gay people, as women, people of color, whatever, are going to be worth a damn. We're going to be dead. So for me, that would probably be the most important thing. And then, of course, after that, second item, which is closely tied with it, really, is the economic situation. If I could right now, I think what I would do is take that tape recorder and go, or some other current digital equipment, and go walking around Portland, Oregon. The last few years, I have seen like an astronomical increase in the number of homeless encampments, people living in tents, people living out of their cars. It's incredible. It reminds me very much of a third world country. And well, I visited Indonesia when I was 40. So however many years, whatever year that was. And 1983, that was it. And I saw people sleeping on the sidewalk, on whole families, on pieces of newspaper. They would just open up a newspaper and that would be their bedding. And it's getting to be like that here, only instead of newspaper, they do have tents and they do have, some people still have their vehicles. And mm-hmm. I see that, and I see that there are three individuals in this country who own more than half, who own more wealth than half the population of this country, than the lower half. And mm-hmm. they got to go. Those people got to go. So if I were going to be doing radio programming, I'd be doing it both about the climate stuff and economic inequality. Because again, without the... if we don't have some kind of fairer distribution, if we don't have healthcare, we're dead. In the job that I've been working on in the last 23 years, really, I've been working with disabled people and seeing people who have lost people who have become disabled through accidents or whatever, and seeing how they've lost their homes, their everything, and all of this money for medical bills. That's got to change. If you and me, in order to pay the rent, outrageous rents, have to work three jobs, what good are our rights? We don't have time to exercise our rights. All we are is serfs.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, those are the top priorities. And then after that comes all of the other stuff.
Right.
Well said.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I will do the rest of the questions. And I think I'm really excited about your answer for this one. There are a couple of tapes in which you interview Audre Lorde, and she reads poetry and it's wonderful. And so we just wanted to know, what was Audre Lorde like and what was your friendship like?
I would say it was more of an acquaintanceship than a close friendship. I don't think I really knew her that well, but we were kind of comrades in arms because of the time and what we were dealing with in terms of anti-gay prejudice and racial prejudice and stuff. Very, very smart, good person mm-hmm. is what I have to say. She was kind to me even when I didn't think I deserved it, so.
Well, that's great. And another question we had was, so there are a couple of tapes where Mary Flower pops in and then pops out, and there's some comedic parts of it, and we've been doing some research and we couldn't find out who Mary Flowerpot is. So I've been really curious.
Okay, I can tell you about that.
Yeah, who is she?
Okay, she was involved in the gay movement at the time. Her real name was Pamela Barnes, and she was from England.
Was an alias.
Yes, Pamela. Yes, Pamela.
Yeah, she asked me if she could do a little something for the show, and I said sure. And so she gave her 5 minutes. Alas, what she kept doing was making it more and more than 5 minutes, which I found annoying, but I thought the stuff that she did was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So then she also moved out. A year or so after I had moved to California, she came out to California as well. So that's a very long story, but we ceased being friends after I'd helped her move, and she was really obnoxious to me.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but it made interesting content for sure. Some abstract, mm-hmm. interesting things going on. And then there were also, I think, two tapes included in the collection that you donated that seem to be recordings of the Feminist Credit Union meeting, and they didn't quite seem to be within the purview of Lesbian Nation. So we're just wondering about like the provenance of where those came from and if they are related to the show or what.
You know, I do not remember. I don't think they were related to the show. Were they about mm-hmm. the credit union in Detroit?
I think Sadie might be able to answer that.
Yeah, I don't recall a specific location being mentioned, but I do it didn't have like the normal introduction that you would give. It was just kind of a straight recording of the meeting. So yeah, there have been a lot of questions floating around in the class of like, does this go in the Lesbian Nation collection, or does it kind of just fall under the purview of like your collection or creation? But yeah, it was kind of a great tape recording.
I don't know. Well, you know, if you could somehow send, you're making it digital. If there's some way you could send that stuff to me, I will listen to it and then tell you what it was about. But,
great.
I'm pretty sure that was not Lesbian Nation stuff. But there was a whole big uproar about the Federal Feminist Credit Union in Detroit and stuff. Do you want to hear that story? Because it's not related to WBAI.
I'm down to hear it.
Yes, we'd love to.
Do tell.
Okay, what happened was, trying to remember the year now. I think it was 77 or 78. There was an abortion clinic, Feminist Women's Health Center in Oakland. There was also a sister clinic like that in Detroit and another one in Los Angeles. It had been started by this woman in Los Angeles. The woman who ran the one in Oakland was the daughter of the one in Los Angeles, and they had vastly different politics. Laura Brown was the name of the woman who was running the one in Oakland. And she was, a petty dictator. and I'm going to shut the door here. Anyway, she got together with the women of Diana Press, and they had this idea of what they call a feminist economic network, making, getting power for women through money. And what they did in Detroit was there was a Federal Feminist Credit Union there that was quite successful. Women would put their money in there like a bank, and then they could borrow money when they needed it. Students at Ann Arbor who wanted to buy a bicycle or whatever it was. So there were the two women who were running the credit union in Detroit. There was two women from Diana Press, which was back on the East Coast. I don't remember exactly where. And then there was the women, Laura Brown and her partner from Oakland. They got together, and what they did was they took over the credit union, and they got eight people to take out like dummy loans of, I don't remember how many thousand, 50,000 each, something like that, and used that to, and this was as loans, and these people weren't qualified for loans. One of them was on welfare, but the idea was to get the money, to take the money out of the credit union and buy the Detroit Women's Center, which had been started years ago Detroit Women's Club, had been started, you know, by these well-to-do women who were feminists and probably from the suffrage days. And they bought it, and the idea was that they were going to use that to start their economic empire. The problem with that is that these were illegal loans, and then the credit union was not capable of giving any loans to any of the women who had deposited the money in there, and those people couldn't get their money back. It was all tied up in this stuff. So the women in Detroit and Ann Arbor were outraged and making a big fuss about it. And what happened then was that Laura Brown and her partner talked to the woman who had started this, the Women's Press Collective that I was working on. And they convinced them that this was a great idea. And this was Judy Grahn, the poet, and her lover at the time, Wendy Cadden. And they were burnt out because running a small press, you either get subsidized, a small publishing company, by somebody. This is not a money-making thing. They had been subsidizing it for years with unpaid labor and with donations. And this was, they seemed like a chance to make money and have actual real jobs with real money coming in. Anyway, they went for it. I had been in the process of moving that Pamela Barnes, Mary Flowerpot, from the East Coast to California, and also raising money for the Press Collective. So I didn't know what was going on. And when I came back, I was, you know, told that this was going to be the great new idea. And I thought it was a really bad idea. So I went to Detroit and interviewed a bunch of people about what was going on. Anyway, the project failed. One of the women, long story, but one of the women notified the government agency that oversees credit unions. And they sent out an investigator to see what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then the women who had started this, Barbara Hoke and Laura Brown, grabbed all of the furniture that they could, including the chandeliers from the Detroit Women's Club, that very nice building, loaded them in U-Hauls, and basically stole them and tore off to California with trucks full of nice furniture, including stuff that they'd bought with the women from the money from the credit union.
Wow.
And it was a nasty business. And it caused me to have a big rift with Judy Grahn, who I dearly love. That lasted for some years until we finally made up. We still disagree politically on that one, but we love each other anyway. So what are you going to do?
Yeah. Wow. What a wild ride on the Feminist Credit Union. But I'm glad that your friendship with Judy Grahn survived.
Yeah. We have a lot in common, and I love her work, and she loves mine, so what can we, you know?
Well, that's great. I think one of the last structured questions that we have was just, what is the accomplishment within your activism that you're most proud of, or you think that was most impactful on the feminist or lesbian world?
Well, that's pretty funny, because I can tell you that what was the most impactful, I'm not sure if it's the thing that I'm most proud of. It just because it was like a spur of the moment thing, it didn't have to do, it didn't take that much, you know, like years of hard labor or anything. It was the day that I called for a march right after Stonewall. And when we started, and out of the little group that was organizing that march, we formed the Gay Liberation Front. And I think that made a huge impact on the world. And how it happened was, you know, I made that phone call like 2 days after the Stonewall riot. Stonewall riot was happening Friday and Saturday night. Monday morning, I found out from the newspaper what it was. And then I called the head of Daughters of Bilitis, who was in the closet because of her job, said we had to have a protest march. She said, call head of Mattachine Society, and if they agree, we'll organize, you know, we'll support one. So I did that, and shortened the story. About a week later, we had a meeting of those people who agreed that we were going to organize that march, and was sitting around drinking beer on a hot Saturday afternoon, and somebody said the words Gay Liberation Front, and I started yelling and pounding my head on the table. Yes, that's it. We're the Gay Liberation Front. And from there on, it was mm-hmm. just one thing after another, one demonstration after another, and putting mm-hmm. out the newspaper, holding dances, everything. What I'm wow. most proud of? I don't know. That was, I don't know. I've written some books that I'm really proud of because those took like 40 years of research to do, but I haven't been able to sell them far and wide because I'm lousy at marketing. I'm good at writing. I'm just not good at marketing.
Yeah, well, hopefully there will be some good outreach now that we're going to have these digitized tapes available for people to access.
I got an idea. Since I mm-hmm. would you be interested in me sending you those books so that I, you know, maybe put them in your archives or whatever?
Yeah, well,
what they are. Go ahead.
Oh, if you send them to the Lesbian History Archives, I'm sure they would love to have them.
Okay, they are. It's a trilogy of historical novels. Main character is a lesbian, but it takes place in the 9th century BC in the Middle East.
That sounds fascinating.
I love it already.
Yeah, I can't wait to read that. Yeah, me too. I mean, we're library students. We love it. let's see if there was another question. Does anybody else have any other questions to address? Any other follow-ups that we're curious about?
I mean, this isn't so much of a question, but just tying into what Martha was talking about earlier about kind of economic injustice. And I think something that I was struck with when reading through a lot of your previous interviews that you've done with other places is that you were really able to dedicate yourself to organizing and activism without, you know, sacrificing your livelihood or like feeling like you didn't have enough time to dedicate it to like you were saying, like it was possible to work part-time and then have Lesbian Nation or activism be your other part-time thing. I don't know.
I want to say something about that. When I was a child, I was born in 1943, the end of 43. When I was a kid, my father worked as a grade 4 government clerk. And he always said that when he looked at the statistics, he was always on the dividing line, federal statistics, between those who were considered poor and those who were considered middle class. He never made it to middle class. There was him, there was my mother, who at that point in life did not work outside the home. I mean, she worked like a dog, but, you know, was taking care of 3 kids plus her elderly parents. So my father was supporting himself, his wife, and 3 children on an income where the net pay was $70 per week. I saw that when he counted it out to my mother on payday. With that, he was able to buy a used car and fix it up. He'd worked as an assistant mechanic during the Great Depression. And during the summer, he was able to take the entire family to the Catskills, rent a little bungalow, and then we'd move up there for the summer after school was out, filling the car with linens, pots and pans and stuff, because you had to, the bungalow, you had to bring your own pots and pans and linens, because there was a mattress and beds. And we would stay there for the entire summer. And he would come up on the weekends and on his 2-week vacation. That's not possible these days. The purchasing mm-hmm. power of the American worker has declined to the point where it takes both parents to earn a living for the family. And there's no way they're going to be able to afford a little bungalow, even that little bungalow for the entire summer. It doesn't, you know, our economy has changed very, very drastically. So when I got to the point where I was doing the Gay Liberation Front work and WBAI work, it was still possible, even though the economy was started in decline then for the ordinary worker, for me to live in a slum apartment paying about $60 a month rent, and where it was considered normal that your housing expense should be one quarter of your income, one week's wages. So I could live in that dinky little slum and work part time and make, you know, that $60. Now, if you take a look at the statistics, a very large number of Americans are paying 50% of their income for renting or more. And that's why there's so many people on the streets, you know, living out of tents and stuff. It's become untenable for ordinary people. And then with healthcare, we had a doctor, you know, primary care doctor down the street. We just walked down the street and there was this little house. He was the only person on the street who had a house. Everybody else was living in apartment buildings. And if you went to see a specialist, which we sometimes did, it was $5 a visit.
Wow.
You didn't have this kind of incredible greed of the health insurance companies. I just bought some prescription toothpaste and it was in June. I got twice the amount, same company, double the amount for half the price. Now all of a sudden I get half the new same prescription. They're giving me a small a tube that's half the amount and the price has gone up like double.
Wow.
So yeah, it was possible then to survive on that scale. And now it's much, much harder, you know, for people to survive economically and be activists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like maybe those two things are interconnected, like so much activism could happen at that time because people had the time to dedicate to it.
It was a combination of that and also kind of the spirit of the times, because we were all at the same time protesting the Vietnam War. There'd been the civil rights movement and the women's movement, the anti-war movement, and all of the consciousness of that. They were feeding on each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm just going to say,
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, hopefully we're on the forefront of a new wave of activism in this country.
I hope so. Whatever it is, it'll be different. And I'm sure hope I live long enough to see more of it.
Yeah.
Oh, one thing I want to tell you for the record, Oregon votes blue, period. There are people, of course, who, you know, are Republicans, but very much outnumbered in Oregon when it comes to voting. And so every time there's a presidential election, it doesn't matter who I vote for, the state goes Democrat. Of course, if we get rid of the Electoral College, this will change. But this year, I wasn't particularly thrilled with Biden, so I wrote in Greta Thunberg. There's only two things wrong with her, really. She's 17 and she's Swedish. She'd make a much better president than anybody else I know.
Oh, wow. Well, that's funny. I'm glad that this whole election mess is coming to a close at least. Well, let's see. Are there any other questions that Sadie or Tiffany, do you have? Are there any questions for us that you have, Martha?
I can't think of any at the moment. I'm really, you know, kind of excited. I thought that the tapes that I had donated probably now would have disintegrated and that would no longer exist. So I'm really happy that it's still there because, mm-hmm. you know, some of that is really important history. Mm-hmm. When you get a chance, listen to the Judy Grand stuff.
Which one?
It's when she reads that poem called A Woman is Talking to Death.
Okay. A Woman is Talking to Death.
Yeah, you'll find it in there somewhere. All right. When you get a chance, that will introduce you to the best of her. Mm-hmm. She's what, 4 years older than me, I think. So I guess she's around 80 now. But talk about firebrand. Mm-hmm. Let me think if I have any questions. If you have any more for me, you know where to reach me. You know,
yes,
things
definitely.
Come up that you, yeah. And if I'm not sure again about that Feminist Credit Center stuff. What those tapes are about.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
if you can't figure it out, just, you know, maybe you can send me something and I'll listen to them and tell you where it was from and so on.
Great.
Yes,
we'll
definitely.
Do that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much for talking to us. This has been really interesting and we're so glad that you were willing to be interviewed. If we have any follow-up questions, we'll let you know. But your tapes are in safe hands with us. We are using them to learn about history and digitization of open reels. I think that's about it.
Oh, okay. And let's see. One other thing I wanted to say. You're living in New York, all of you, right?
Yes.
Okay. If this coronavirus goes away and I ever get there, maybe we can all meet in person.
Yeah. That would be great.
I would love that. Yes.
Yeah, I'd be honored.
I would be delighted. It would be so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. Well,
okay.
I think I'm going to sign off. This has been such a lovely time. Thank you again
so
much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. You take care. And thank you.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.